Florida Movement Center today. We've been having a lot of interviews trying to put together a tapestry of reconstructing past history and trying to figure out where this movement should go today. So I'm very happy to have the next conversation with Danny Glover. We know Danny Glover was involved in the San Francisco State Strike, which is one of his highlights in my view of his life. He's obviously been a tremendous actor and a tremendous contributor to society, and one of the few actors that seems to have a movement mind that somehow managed to navigate being both a celebrity, which is part of capitalism, and a public persona, and yet have a grassroots consciousness. So, Danny Glover, nice to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure, Eric. Yeah.
Where were you in the summer of 1964?
In the summer of 1964, I was in San Francisco. I graduated from high school in June of 1964. In fact, I had to go to summer school to pick up a few more credits to finally graduate in August, 1964. But for me and others, we ferociously followed what was happening here and have been for years. You know, it's one of those moments where you live vicariously through the actions of others as a young person, you know. I mean, the names of Bob Moses, Fannie Lou Hamer, and Diane Nash, and many other kind of heroes and sheroes of the moment were names that I was certainly aware of, and names that I knew long before I actually met those men and women. So I was there in that summer and following it closely. And as I said earlier, it had an extraordinary impact on me, and certainly that impact would find itself in my engagement as a student to San Francisco State College. It was a place starting in about 1966 that I found that connection with my own activism. It's one thing to imagine yourself and see yourself through the lens of what other people do, but came apparent in my life that there was a moment engagement in activism that I had an opportunity to be involved with. First,
well, it's a big thing because a lot of people have opinions. A lot of people go to demonstrations, which is great. Mm. But there's a moment when you sort of take one step in front of another, and next thing you know, you're in an organization. Mm. And then that changes.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Then you have to build that organization. Are you going to really show up for the meetings? Do you want to really help build it? Mm. So what was the first actual organized form of struggle that you joined?
Well, the first... It was at 20 years old, and I was involved in building support for people who were being displaced by redevelopment. Right. We call it gentrification, that was redevelopment. Yeah. And it was a traditional black neighborhood in San Francisco, the Fillmore district, which is often referred to Harlem West. And there was a movement beginning long before my first contact with it in late 1966 around gaining access and also being able to have a voice within the changes that were occurring in people's lives. And that was a multi-generational movement. You had retirees. It was also a multi-racial, a man named Yura Wada, who ran the boys club that we often, who was Japanese descent, ran the boys club, was a part of that and was active in it as well. So there was a great deal of activism that I found myself engaged in it. And let me preface that, the BSU, the Black Student Union, right. Now, because it's of its desire and mandate to bring the college to the campus, I mean the campus to the community, and the community to the campus, and some of those members, some of those men and women had been members of SNCC, right. Who came there and were in the leadership, and had spent that 5 years of their lives working on behalf of civil rights in places like Mississippi and others, had now come back to school and now brought some of those skills of organizing and organizing communities. And so we weren't just some students within a certain kind of vacuum, the one a contextual vacuum, where we can talk about the issues that were happening within the community on campus. We're also students who are now participating with the various actors and the various participants in that struggle off campus as well.
Well, 1966 is a very important year because after the defeat and victory of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, mm-hmm. a lot of us rejected the Democratic Party and began to move in a more revolutionary direction, began to feel that Stokely went to Lowndes County, Alabama, and he built the first Black Panther Party, which people don't know was with John Hewlett and with Southern sharecroppers.
Yeah,
that was the first Black Panther Party. And by 1966, a lot of us were moving to try to think about some kind of revolutionary direction. There was a lot of discussion of Black Power. Mm. There was a lot of discussion about allying with the Vietnamese and a part of a third world movement. Mm. What were some of the ideologies that were floating around in your mind in 1966?
Well, some of that really, I think, came out of first black art, even though I didn't consider myself an artist at that time. I never acted in my life and never been on stage in my life. But some of that came out of art first, black art. I mean, what occurred at San Francisco State as this process began to unfold was that we would have various opportunities to participate in whether it's dance or in supporting dance, supporting poetry, exporting drama and everything else. And it began that people like Sonia Sanchez, who I met, first saw read in 1966, in the summer of 1966, other poets, people like Ed Bullens, found their way to San Francisco and were there. And just at that particular moment, this energy now began to get refocused when we invited Amiri Baraka out to San Francisco State in the spring of 1967. So he was out there from January on through the spring and on through the summer, the summer at San Francisco State. And it began that, in a sense, now repositioned to BSU, just the power to bring him out there. And Amiri, in his way, was always talking about community development, the whole idea of using art as a platform for a community engagement and the community's voice, the resonance of the community's voice as well. And so that was the first time I became involved in acting. I was a member of the BSU. We had a central committee, and I was a part of that central committee. And it was the first time that I've ever stepped on stage, never thinking that I was going to have a career in it, but certainly was a part of a process that was happening. And I think that, in a sense, set in motion several things at that moment. So my first, coupled with our engagement with the organization like the Western Addition Community Organization, WACO,
that's right,
in San Francisco, coupled with that relationship with that, now we had various other advantages in which we can participate in what was happening in the community. The film was specifically, but it also involved the southeast part of San Francisco, the Baby Hunters Point in it as well. But now we engage that, because another thing that we were able to do, and associate, and this is the skills of a former SNCC workers who knew how to organize. You used the word before, organize. They knew how to organize. They knew where to find, where the center for resources were. In this case, in a liberal teacher's college, San Francisco State,
right. You
had various advantages, various ways in which you can now insert yourself in controlling the associated student budget. And we were able to do that, and as a result of that, we were able to not only control the associated student budget, also because it was a teacher college, and mind you, San Francisco State was a teacher's college, and one of the platforms in terms of acculturating teachers to the profession would be the tutorial program. And there were 10 centers in around the city in various communities. So we had access to that as well. So they gave us access to households through the tutorial program. We had access to some of the same households through the Western Addition Community Organization, and we had another level of access through our participation in the Betrayal Hill Neighborhood House and other events. In fact, we negotiated an arrangement with Bill Graham when Mary Brack was out there in 1967 to use the old Fillmore Auditorium there. So all these things were very allowed us because of the strategic view of access, accessing various other places, spaces we're on the campus, and translating that into a working relationship with the community as well.
Well, you know, during the 30s, obviously, the Communist Party understood the need for a sort of a comprehensive movement. Mm. So they did work in the arts. They did work among immigrants. They did work. They sent people into the factories. They sent people into public office. You know, black people, Ben Davis was elected in the city council.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Paul Robeson was working in the arts.
Yes, sir.
And there's the illusion that those of us in the New Left were anarchists and we didn't like organization. That is not true.
Absolutely.
We had a brilliant understanding. We were trying to build, like as you were describing, a citywide movement. You're trying to move on the curriculum.
Yeah.
You're trying to move through the black arts movement. You're trying to impact artists to become more politically involved.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're trying to ally with the community and tell the university, these are not your resources. These resources must be shared with the community.
Mm-hmm.
We want a role in governance. And they said, what do you mean a role in governance?
Yeah.
All your students.
Yeah.
And if you look at all the FBI tapes, what they were saying is, this is scary stuff because this is the beginning of rejecting U.S. society in a very fundamental way.
Yeah, of course.
What was the most radical understanding you had of where the work was going, and how did this start intersecting your evolution as an actor?
Well, certainly my idea of an actor didn't come till later on, after I finished college, even though I'd worked in theater and was on the BSU, the Minister of Culture on the Central Committee,
right,
and organized that, those kind of artistic activities. I wasn't, acting was nothing that I really thought about doing as a profession. I knew that whatever job I took after finishing college would be one of, in some sort of service industry. So at the time, while my others were going to law school, my idea that I was find some work that was attached to the work I'd been doing with Waco and working in communities. And it ended up as well after doing my internship at the Berkeley City Planning Department in the summer of 1971. I came to the city and county of San Francisco midway through that year, in that year in the fall, and began to work for the Model Cities Program in the Office of Community Development.
Well, that's interesting because the Model Cities was, to us, much more corporate development than people's development.
Well, one of the things that was very interesting, and because this is one of the things that we kind of missed in this whole process, because these were block grants given to cities and given to the community, and each community used it well. In fact, what was split between the Baby Hunters Point and the Mission was, which is a Hispanic community, largely Hispanic community, was $3 million. So the idea, what was so extraordinary, was the level of what I would call organic, grassroots, political engagement, democratic engagement. And then these leaders, these women who, primarily in the Baby Hunters Point, were extraordinary from the vantage point. They were controlled this neighborhood and really were had levels of activism and levels of organic intelligence and everything, and power, wielding power, that we were kind of like, we often had to feed out of their hand, in a sense. So it was a different kind of relationship here in this when money was attached. Now, the Mission was quite different, because the Mission District in San Francisco is not a homogeneous community of, say, immigrants from Mexico. In fact, largely in San Francisco, they come from Central America. So what you had in the Mission were various other dynamics which you didn't see. One element that you had that brought people together was the whole of language.
Right.
People came together. Often you find people who were coming from the devastation of the earthquake in Nicaragua in 1972, or the devastation that was happening around the movements, struggle movements, where people were paying political exiles and everything else. So it was a different kind of calculus and discussion within the Mission District. And so you would have in the Mission District the Mission Cultural Center, or the Mission Reading Program, or the Mission Hiring Hall.
Right.
Those were part of that. I happened to be a program manager and evaluation specialist for the Mission Reading Clinic, and which was one of the most 25 most effective reading programs in the country at this time. So on the one hand, when I saw two different dynamics were happening, and often my colleagues in the Mission were a little bit more politically, how would you say, politically progressive and radical because of the movements that they had come out of than what I found in the Baby Hunters Point. And that's a kind of generalization in a sense, but the movements they came out of them forced them to develop another political culture in order to deal with the issues they had to deal with.
Well, let's talk about
it's a very interesting kind of dynamic in Washington's community. Both are driven by real grassroots political process, but you see them coming to their respective ends in different ways. So on the one hand, now, from the experience I had had in San Francisco State as a college student, now I'm put in a position, in a situation where I'm able to kind of see how people organize their life in a different way, given use the resources in a different way. And I found the most how effective the mission programs use their resources. And there was lines of accountability as well. So,
before we get into the questions of the culture, Danny. Wait, let me we can move for a bit. One of the things that when I joined, you know, CORE and SNCC was, of course, the SNCC Freedom Singers and the beginning of that form. Then we learned the art of oratory, that you had to entertain as well as educate.
Mm-hmm.
The bar was set very high. Malcolm, King, I'm pretty good. And I'll tell you, I got pretty good because you get booed off the stage if you want. So, I mean, it was, people just didn't want, they didn't want to hear speeches.
Yeah.
They wanted to hear performances. And then along came black arts, and along came the role of plays and guerrilla theaters.
Mm.
And so when did you begin to think about, like you said, you were Minister of Culture. Now tell me a little bit about the advancement of your own acting career and the effort to keep the intersection of politics and acting.
Well, one of the things that happened, because I mean, it was so instructive when you do the kind of political theater we were doing when Mary Baraka came out of San Francisco, the first militant preacher, The Job, Mad Heart, Jimmy Garrett's We Own the Night, Ed Bullen's How Do You Do, was a series of first plays that we did, and we build on that, and certainly Marvin Jackman's, Marvin X's, Flowers of the Trash Man. So one of the things is that you get a sense, the purpose of theater is not only to entertain people, but also to allow them to see themselves. And the purpose of theater, as stark as it was in political theater, it was transformative in a way. It was an attempt to be transformative. So that's one part of that. And that's the one first lesson, the use of art. The use of art not only to communicate, but also to move people to political action. That's the first thing. So that was one stage. And that stage was a stage that lasted only when I was in college. Then I stopped doing Wins Once and just worked full time and talked with the other things. And then I decided to join an improv group with a friend of mine. We had been in an improv group before, and the improv was very fascinating. This is about the time of 1974. I'd come back to that 1974, come back to doing that, and had an opportunity to go to the American Conservatory Theater, ACT at night. Met someone who became a very important force in my life, Zace Mokai. A South African actor.
Yes,
exile.
I am well.
Man, Zace and I.
Well, but see that, let me say, when I say him, well, I don't know him at all. I mean, I love his work.
Yeah.
In the Dry White Season, I still remember the line. Where he turns around to Donald Sutherland and says, Donald Sutherland says, we Africans have to turn around and says, just be careful. just don't do this weed. That was one of the great lines of all time.
I mean, Zace Mokai in 1975, you know, we had been with the first session of the Black Actors Workshop night program, which I went to six nights a week, and everything else. There was movement, everything, but it dealt with something else as well. Dialects, accents. We did a Steve Garter play, we did plays, Trinidadian plays, and we did everything else. But through Zace Mokai and a great friend of mine who's still, we're still great friends, and we've known each other since we were hippies together, Ben Guillory, who was in the regular program, handed me the Blood Knot. I thought for God, the great South African playwright.
Yes.
And if you want to note a transformative moment, you take that moment of reading, and as much as the work was political, it is defined in the same ways that we define Arthur Miller in Death of a Salesman, or Lorraine Hansberry with Raisin in the Sun. You can go on and on and on and on and on. And it provided me with three things. It allowed me to learn the craft of acting, language, words, stories, do that. The second thing, it allowed me to say, what was important in the world to me. And thirdly, it allowed me to say whose side in the world I was on. All those things were encompassed in that moment. If I can go back to that realization, it just opened up a whole door for me. It put me in a situation when you do plays like The Island and Sees Way Bonzi is Dead, in the middle of that you're working in part with the African Liberation Support Committee, you put it right in the center of it. The work drives you and places you right in the center of it. And that's what happened to me. And my career began to focus on that. I never thought of a film career. I thought of a theatrical career. And it put me right in the center doing that work. And I probably did as much for God as anybody in the country during that period of time.
Of the strange vicissitudes of human beings is when I was working at General Motors, I told you about this campaign to keep the General Motors plant open.
Yeah.
But I was working with a communist group at the time. And I was one of the leaders in the movement. So there was a lot of anti-communism going around in the movement trying to attack us. So we're trying to think, well, how are we going to deal with this? How are we going to solve this? So this guy, Bennett Guillory, have you ever heard of him? Your friend Bennett Guillory, right?
Yeah, Bennett in San Francisco?
Yeah, no, he was in L.A.
When? Just recently? When?
No, this is 20 years ago.
Yeah, Ben.
Yeah.
Ben, you know Ben?
Yes, that's what I'm getting to. So this guy, Bennett Guillory, along with this other guy, Charlie, somebody, I'm really sorry I forget his name, come up to us and say, we have an idea. We're going to read Paul Robeson's rejection of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Thank you. Ben did that play.
Water workers.
Ben did that play.
Okay.
Ben did that play.
So we bring him in, and these water workers going, yeah, the hell with the government. Yeah, defend that communist. It worked. They had to see a real actor, and this is in a union hall, in a big rally to keep the plant open, and we wanted to push the consciousness of workers to expose them to things they've never been exposed to.
That's the same Ben. That's the same Ben. Ben and I have known each other since we were 16 years old, man.
So tell them hello.
Yeah, and Ben, we formed, it's our 20th year, we formed Roby Theater Company. So here you are, first of all, and Carl Lumley and I did Sees Way Bonzi is Dead in San Francisco. We tried to take the play down to L.A. and couldn't take it down to L.A. because an equity company of Sees Way Bonzi is Dead was coming in 1977, 78. And so we ended up doing The Island with Ann Bowen. And The Island was, it was my favorite of Fugard's, so my favorite of Island. It's just the two men on Robben Island. Oh. And they're both sentenced, one is sentenced to life, the other one's sentenced to a term, and one of them gets his sentence reduced and is about to leave. In the midst of them doing the play Antigone, they're planning to do an Antigone. They work in the quarries and everything else. They nurture each other, you know, and everything else. And it was done brilliantly in rep with Sees Way Bonzi is Dead, with John Connie and Winston Nishama on Broadway. And I'm running the Tonys for that. So we end up doing that. I end up in New York on a fluke off Broadway doing Blood Knot in 1979, 1980. Who walks into the rehearsal of a run-through, but I thought for God. Small theater, the Roundabout. When the Roundabout, it was a little tiny theater that didn't pay his extras. They didn't get a cashier checks and run-through to make sure the cashier check didn't bounce. And you never know. And in 1982, for God asked me to come with Zay Smoke High and do Master Hair on the Boys at Yale Rep. It went directly to Broadway, and Robbie Benton saw me in it and hired me for Places in the Heart in 1983. But it was always a through line, and I think that all along, the one thing that was constant, you know, whatever the projection of, and I'll say this in my own terms, that I felt I was doing movement work. And that every performance had value. And I felt that every time I performed that, it gave value and gave voice. And in those moments, everything was up in the air. Nobody knew what was going to happen with South Africa,
right,
you know.
Right.
It's a constructive engagement, all the kits and the mix and stuff, and all that stuff had gone through there. And the Delibus language is in jail, and that we were doing this work here. And whether it was on Broadway, and I'm saying the work of building, whether it's Maxine Waters, who led divestment movement in the California State Senate, you know, to Ron Dellums, who was pushing for an embargo and sanctions on South Africa in the U.S. Congress. All those particular things were the things, and the work, the cultural work that we're doing. So the cultural work was that? I remember I was just in Toronto at the Mandela Foundation Gala last week in Toronto, and I hadn't sat with the fact that Mandela was gone and everything else, and they started playing Shoshaloza, Shoshaloza, and it's a song that I heard like 40-some years ago. And I knew that the moment I heard it, it was always one of those songs that broke, because I would be at a party with South Africans who were exile in the mid-70s and late-70s, not knowing. And all of a sudden, at about 2 in the morning, people would start, got drunk and started singing freedom songs or liberation songs, or songs from home, you know. And then it would come down to everybody was crying, you know what I'm saying? So the opportunity, I think, to do that work, and I say this now, and to learn the craft of acting, it was the highlight for me at that moment. You know, learning the craft of acting and knowing that I was giving specific value to my work. Every time I worked on that stage, it couldn't get better than that.
Well, Danny Glover, what I can see is there'll never be a final sentence. There'll only be, we got to keep talking.
We got to keep talking,
and
man.
We'd love to do that. So,
yeah.
Danny Glover, it's been a tremendous pleasure.
Yeah.
A little bit getting to know you. This is Voices from the Frontlines. I hope you can see it's a different kind of show.
Yeah.
It's a conversation. It's about two people trying to think out loud, and our listeners are having the kind of conversations they need to hear.
Yeah.
So I think when we put together the conversation I had with Ross Watkins, with Dave Dennis, with many other people, we're gonna try to put together in some kind of film that we don't exactly know what, and put it together. But it's going to sort of be calling Conversations About the 50th Anniversary.
I mean,
and we're excited about putting it together, and you've made a tremendous contribution to that conversation.
Thank you so much. You know, thank you so much, man. Thank
All
you.
Right, my brother.
All right, then. All right, then.
So this is Eric Mann. This is still Voices from the Frontlines. I'm going through a consciousness-raising experience, ladies and gentlemen. Every interview is blowing my mind, and this has been another one. And we are really lucky. I mean, what kind of revolutionary can have a show at the president of Tougaloo College in her office?
Yeah.
And we want to thank again Dr. Hogan for this amazing hospitality. We want to thank Danny Glover for a life well-lived and a life with many more acts in the play. I want to thank the whole team that we work together on, and Voices from the Frontlines. It may be old, but it's still good. All power to the people.
Just move on up to a greater day. With just a little faith, if you put your mind to it, you can surely do it.
So hey everybody, this is Eric Mann. We're on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK 90.7 FM, part of the Pacifica Network. And we're here in Jackson, Mississippi for the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, Mississippi Summer. And we've been having some wonderful guests. And today, the next guest is Frankie Adams Johnson, also known as Malika, or she says Mississippi Frankie and New York Malika. So maybe we'll start the conversation there. Why do you use that?
I tell you, during my movement experience, particularly when I went into New York and joined the Black Panther Party, there was some of us was changing names. I maintain Frankie. I refuse to change my name legally because I value my Mississippi roots. And so that's why I call myself Mississippi Frankie and New York Malika.
Sounds good. I think the whole question of identity is very important for Black people and for Black women trying to figure out multiple identities and even multiple politics. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your Mississippi experience, and I'd like to really jump right into Mississippi Summer, if that's okay, even if there's a lot of backstory, because I want to do some forward story.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you first come to Mississippi?
Actually, I was born and raised here in Mississippi.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I was born and raised here in Mississippi in a little, very small town right up the road, a piece about 9 miles from here. And I was born in a little small town called Pocahontas, Mississippi. We were often teased when I was young. It's so small, you had to poke your way in and hunt your way out. Yeah, so that is where my early childhood was, in Pocahontas, Mississippi. And then my mother was tired of the life of a sharecropper and moved our family to Jackson, Mississippi for the supposedly a better life, and that was in 59. And so it was here in Jackson that I became conscious of movement activities that was going on in the state of Mississippi. And the year prior to 1964, I was a student at one of the three black high schools here in Jackson, Mississippi. And during that time, I was a junior in high school in 63. And in 1963, there were a lot going on here in Mississippi. And one of the incidents that really got me involved as a part of the high school walkouts that students here from Tougaloo College, under Tougaloo Nan, they are referred to, that Tougaloo Nan was 61, but Tougaloo College students did a sit-in at the Woolworth County, and the high school students, and respond to the brutality and all of the brutality they experienced during that sit-out. The high school students reorganized and walked out of each one of the respective high schools, mine being Brinkley Junior High School. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things you just described, starting with the brutality of sharecropping work, that the semi-slavery of the South in the 1960s, the Jim Crow system, was very brutal economically as well as politically. Did you experience a great deal of the perception of white terrorism?
I tell you, we were kind of, it was really interesting in our growing up in such a system that most of the time, we were very separated, and I rarely saw white people, but I learned mostly about the brutality and the cruelty of white folks. I often refer to the world that I grew up in. There was the white side, and there was the black side, and so our parents were very, very protective, and the first that I knew up front and the fear of what it meant for us as children were doing the murder of Emmett Till's, and our parents were very, very concerned and very scared for children, for their children. And so most of the time, we were very, very protected as a young person. And most of the brutality that I know is from hearing my parents, my family members talk about what it meant to be a sharecropper, how difficult that life was, and the brutality of what even our parents experienced being domestic workers.
Well, it's interesting because there's just so many different things. One is that one of the reasons I hate Franklin Delano Roosevelt is because I think he was a really big racist. And he passed the National Labor Relations Board, which protected workers, except for two types of workers, agricultural workers and domestic workers.
Yes.
And those were both black people's jobs at the time.
Those were the only jobs.
Yeah. And the white South knew that. So the white South wanted to protect, you know, white workers and excluded her. So it was just interesting about how your mother left sharecropping to go for a, quote, better life, doing domestic work.
But that better life that she came into, was Jackson, was still domestic work.
Right.
Yeah.
So walking out, I mean, for a black person in Mississippi, doing anything must have involved understanding there could be severe consequences.
It very much
did.
Right?
That no one would think, oh, let's just walk out. People would understand, am I right, that do the students understand, well, if we walk out, there may be consequences, or
I don't know that even crossed our minds, the consequences, even when we walked out of the high school. We knew why we were walking out, and that students from the college had been brutalized at the Woolworth County. It was once one of the most bloody sit-ins here in Mississippi, and we knew that, and I know I, as a young person, it just never crossed my mind that what we experienced with that walkout, we'd only gotten, the plan was that the three high schools would eventually meet up down. We would march from our respective schools and end up downtown Jackson. And we had gotten about a quarter of a mile from the school when we were arrested and put in garbage trucks, whatever vehicles. If you know, there were not enough paddy wagons to hold all of the students. So it was, I think, that experience where we're awakening that yes, the brutality was very, very real. And the place that we were housed, where it was the state fairground. And that is the place where we were housed, was where the livestock was kept, you know. And it's really, Mega Evers often referred to it as a concentration camp. And as I grew older in my understanding and my knowledge of brutality and concentration camps and other places, that so we lacked that experience too, being locked down in a concentration camp.
Well, one of the things, you know, there's certain themes that have been coming up on the show a lot, and I do a lot of reading, but I am shocked at how influential Medgar Evers was.
Very much.
I mean, I knew he was famous. I knew he had been assassinated. I understood he was head of the state NAACP, but the number of people, actual people, who are saying, Medgar Evers drove me here, Medgar Evers taught me this,
right.
Medgar Evers, so tell me a little bit about...
Medgar Evers was our Mississippi hero. There was Martin Luther King, but Medgar Evers was my first movement hero. One of the things that Medgar Evers was really very strong about was reaching out to younger people such as I, you know, 17 years old, the high school students, and encouraging us and talking to us about our responsibility and our civic duty is to do something to make a difference. As a matter of fact, when we talk about brutality, I think the danger of what it meant to be involved in this movement was my awakening with the assassination of Medgar Evers. As a matter of fact, I was with Medgar Evers for about 15 minutes before that assassination, because one of the things that he did after each mass meeting was to make sure, since he involved us in movement activities, that he also was very protective and very concerned about our well-being and very concerned about our safety. And that night that he was assassinated, he actually had offered to bring me home, but someone else brought me home that lived near to where I was. But it's just really interesting, and I often wonder what would have happened if he had driven me home. So that always kind of goes around in my head, what would have happened. But it was kind of a turning point for me in terms of the nonviolent peace. I did not attend, many of us didn't attend his funeral, because when they assassinated him, we took to the street, and I was actually incarcerated. And on that march, where I was incarcerated, I was my first experience of personally experiencing the brutality. I was hit across my back very brutally by a police officer, and it brought to question a lot for me whether I really was nonviolent, you know, or the nonviolent concept of being hit across my back. A white racist police here in Jackson was the first man that had ever hit me. I was not hit by a father. You know, so I reacted, and I'm very grateful and thank God that there were other people on the paddy wagon, and because my first reaction was to hit back, and the man did cock his rifle, and I could have gotten shot down there. Yeah.
Thank you for telling me a lot of these stories. And one thing I was thinking about is that when I was at the SNCC reunion in
2010,
a lot of women were talking about Jim Foreman encouraging them. And now, in this one, I'm hearing a lot of women talking about Medgar Evers encouraging them. So in terms of the view of the rising of women during the Civil Rights Movement, is it fair to say that both Jim Foreman and Medgar Evers were really consciously trying to build women's leadership?
It's a very touchy issue, because this movement is pretty much a male-dominated movement. It has been a pretty much male-dominated movement. And Medgar Evers probably was more sensitive to women. I did not know Jim Foreman that well. So I would say that with Medgar Evers encouraged. I did not consider him, because he did not. Matter of fact, the leadership here in the Jackson Youth Movement were females. The Jackson Youth Movement were headed up by females. There was a woman that was here at Tougaloo College, where she was a part of the Woodwork sit-in, Perlina Lewis, and she's now deceased. But Perlina Lewis actually headed up the Jackson branch of the youth movement, and she was very influential in bringing people like myself, that we were here in Mississippi, you know, we're very community-orientated, and so she was a member of the neighborhood that I lived in. And so I would say that Medgar Evers, you have Joyce and Dury Latimer, who was also mentored by Medgar Evers. All those women played leadership role here in Jackson.
So what brought you to SNCC?
Being a student here at Tougaloo, I was moved by the movement in 63. So when I got here on this campus as a pre-freshman, the movement was here. It was the hotbed of the movement. And so I actually was not a field secretary of SNCC. I was what is called a SNCC worker. And so there were people, SNCC, and it was interesting that I did not, well, freedom, we were all considered ourselves freedoms, that we were fighting for freedom, and we were freedom fighters. And so organizational difference, the different organizations we all were working, particularly while Mega was alive, all of the organizations pretty much worked together. And I tell you, when I got here on Tougaloo's campus, I became more aware of the number of SNCC people and the number of SNCC people, particularly from out of state. And that's pretty much how I got involved. I came here just during the Freedom Summer 64. It was June that I came as a pre-freshman. And what got me into SNCC is, as I say, I came here with having been inspired as an activist in 63, so it was just naturally that I would gravitate to the activists that was here on this campus. And as a matter of fact, being an activist here on this campus got me in a lot of trouble because it distracted me from what I was here for, to be a young freshman in a pre-freshman program preparing me for college life. And I was more involved with movement life, and so I was not allowed to even attend the second section of the pre-freshman program because of that environment.
When you came in June and you were at Tougaloo, did you go out into communities trying to get people to...
Yes, that's exactly what I say. They were taking young students, students like myself, the older people. Most of the SNCC people are older than I, so they were taking young people up to the Delta to do voter registration, down to Macon, and so I got a chance to go up to Greenwood and do voter registration work in Greenwood.
Well, what's interesting is I've been an organizer my whole life. And like when I organized in Newark in the black community, not as many people, when you knocked on the door, were actually interested in getting involved. And one of the things that I'm learning about this is that the question of the vote was in some way symbolized like an anti-colonial movement that people had been given, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, and was not being enforced. So I think that as I'm learning from this, that the concept of voting really meant a lot to black people. Is that right?
Absolutely, because, well, you gotta understand that it was so difficult for black people to vote here, and probably from history, from probably reading of how difficult it was, how difficult the test was, and the threat of voting. You know, people could lose their lives for voting. People could get kicked off the farm for voting. And Vanda Lama was a prime example of the brutality she experienced for attempting to vote.
Well, we're going to hop ahead now, because after the Mississippi Freedom Democratic sellout by the Democratic Party, I was in the Congress of Racial Equality at the time.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people drew some very revolutionary conclusions by that. Some people felt that they still wanted to go back and try to make the Democratic Party work, but Stokely went on to build the Black Panther Party in Lowndes County.
Right, right.
With John Hewlett. How did you end up in the Black Panther Party?
Ah, oh, now that's an interesting question. In 1967, I left Mississippi, and I left Mississippi for several reasons. One, my mother was very fearful because I had gotten really active. The movement had become my life, and I probably went to sleep with freedom on my mind, rose with freedom on my mind, and I think during the summer of 64, my mother had started getting a bit fearful for me in terms of my activism, and so she was fearful for me because of so much brutality. Talented at school, and I also was fearing that something was going to happen to me. And my sister had come home. She was living in New York, so my older sister had come home to visit, and my mother encouraged her to take me from Mississippi. And once I arrived in New York, as I say, movement had become part of my life, and I went into White Plains, New York, and as a young person in my head, I just thought movement activities was going on all over the country, and so I felt very, very restless in White Plains in New York because, as I say, movement was my life, and there was not much going on there. But so I started inquiring about, well, where's the movement? I asked my sister, where's the movement? And so she did introduce me to a culture nationalist group, and so I spent some time with them. But most of those women, they sat and they talked. We spent a whole summer, Sunday afternoon, basically with rhetoric, and there was really no direct action, and I was looking for direct action. On one of those trips into the city, I saw these young men on the street doing the kind of stuff that I was used to doing, you know, working among the community people. And I inquired about, well, who are they? Someone said, they're Black Panthers. Well, I want to be a part of that. And I inquired about how to form a Black Panther Party in the White Plains, New York. So that Sunday, they said they would send some young men out to talk to us about how my sister and I, how to start a branch of a Black Panther Party. And so actually my sister and I started the first branch of the Black Black Panther Party in White Plains, New York. And so that was in 1968. And so I became a full-fledged Black Panther. And contrary to the media, has made it seem like Black Panther Party was about gun-toting revolutionaries and killing cops. And so that's mostly what people know about the Black Panther Party. But what I liked about the Black Panther Party is that we were utilizing the same skills in terms of community organizing that I had learned from my involvement with SNCC and my organizing skills here. So I became really good at what I was doing in White Plains, and then the leadership transferred me into Brooklyn, New York, and one of the really rough parts of New York City, Brownsville,
yes.
New York. One of the biggest ghettos there and one of the roughest communities, so I was transferred.
And your mom said, why did I take you out of Mississippi?
Really? And there
oh,
you
no. Wait a minute.
What has happened?
My daughter's in the Black Panther Party. I want to go back to Mississippi. I'm not really, but you know, like she thought she was protecting you, right?
Yeah, she thought she was protecting me by
so
sending me off to New York.
In Brownsville,
yeah.
The Black Panther. I just wanted to say one thing, Frankie, that there's such a terrible rewriting of history, destruction of revolutionary history. One of the things that people don't understand is how popular the Black Panther Party was. They sold 250,000 copies of the Black Panther Party in a week.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had chapters all over the place. And they had many, many supporters on the college campuses. The Black students, I mean, when Huey Newton was speaking, when Eldridge Cleaver was speaking, when Kathleen Sleeve was speaking, maybe 500 people, thousands of people. Now they make it look like a small group of people marching around, you know, with the berets and, as they say, the Black community didn't like the Panthers, you know.
Oh, the Black community loved the Panthers, particularly. The college students were the major force in terms of helping us run the programs. Our breakfast program, early in the morning, they would get up and they would come to the office, you know, seeking work. And so I organized in Brooklyn, and we had a large, large group of people. And the City College of New York had a big student organization there. It was in Brooklyn College, in Brooklyn. Students were very involved, Long Island University, so the students were definitely, and we, you know, had what we call political education classes, you know, that students would come to our office for a political education class. So it was definitely not an isolated group that did not have any support at all. We had definitely community support, and they looked for us to resolve the kind of atrocity that they were experiencing. And it was really interesting that when I left Mississippi, I knew segregation in Mississippi. Yes, and I left White Plains and went to Brooklyn, New York, and that experience there, what I experienced in New York, it was a rude awakening for me because I thought that things were really bad here in Mississippi, but the kind of a poverty and the way people were forced to live with rats and roaches, and which gave rise to many of our programs, you know, particularly because children actually did go hungry.
That's
children
right.
in
That's
New
right.
York really went hungry. You know what I found there, that children in New York went with roaches in their ears and being bitten by rats, and which gave rise to our free health clinics because we treated a lot of children that actually would come there being bitten by rats. And the housing, our housing program, and the decent, you know, decent houses fit for the shelter of human beings. I did not know, even in our poverty here in Mississippi, I never knew what it was to go hungry. I just never knew what it was to go on because we lived off the land. And so I did not know. So that I learned more about the suffering of Black people, that kind of suffering that I saw Black people experiencing in New York really was a rude awakening for me, that the North was not the great promised land that many of us here in the South, you know, about with the great migration of moving to the North for a better life. And so I remember when I was the officer today for the Brooklyn office, and I remember sitting in the office, and I have a poem written about the rats playing baseball because I could sit right there in that office and see directly across the street from me in a vacant lot that the rats ran. I say playing baseball because they ran around in circles, you know.
Well, yeah. What you're describing is helpful because sometimes I feel bad that I didn't go in the South. I was in Corps in the North, but as you're describing, in Harlem, where I worked, in Newark, where I worked.
Yes.
It was pretty brutal. I mean, we used to have a slogan called No Rent for Rat. You know, we'd be on rent strike. And people would talk about rats.
And give them the names. Right? Yes.
The rats as big as
biggest cats.
You know, and real kids would grow up with that. We moved into these apartments. They had these strip across the top of the apartment, like that wooden molding.
Yes.
We lived in the communities.
So we lived in the communities.
Apartment. We knew what we were getting. You go to the molding, and we tear off the molding, and there are a million roaches. And we all have these guns, I forgot what it was called, spraying them, like going to war with them, and they're dropping. You know, they're dropping, but we literally had to go to war with the rats and roaches just to live. And in the cold during the winter, no heat.
Yes.
And no food.
And children having to fend for themselves. I remember one morning going to, because we would be up early in the morning, maybe 4:30 in the morning, you know, preparing breakfast. And I do remember on one of those occasions when we'd go, because we'd go and round up the children to bring them to the breakfast program. And I remember a 4-year-old one morning up trying to, was on top of some kind of stand and trying to feed himself, you know, trying to feed himself. So.
Well, one thing I've been saying, I've been trying to do a lot of, I wrote a book called Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, I'm talking about the great counter-revolution against what we did. And what I say is, what you don't understand is they went after us because how successful we were.
And that's exactly what it was.
Because the Panthers were brilliant, and Fred Hampton was leading. I saw a film about this with my own eyes. 300 young kids at 6 in the morning doing calisthenics in a high school.
Right.
So they came up with breakfast programs. They came up with health programs.
And educational programs also, the liberation schools.
And the Panthers were attacked because of how successful they were.
And I think one of the things that people don't know is that now the government funds breakfast program that is totally different from our breakfast program in the sense of what they are feeding children, because we were always also conscious about making sure that children had a full stomach to go to school, because, I mean, you're sitting in the classroom hungry. How can you grasp what the teacher's talking about? And so one of the things that we did in our breakfast program was to hold the business people accountable to make them give back to the community. So we never bought, we made them. We made them,
right.
You know, donate the food for those breakfast programs.
What was the end of your Panther experience?
The end of my Panther experience, let's see now, what is the end? Let's start with the beginning to the end. And it was actually, in terms of actually being a Panther organization, where we all work harmoniously together. That was from 68 until 71. And then, of course, you know, there was a split in the Black Panther Party. And so with that split in the Black Party, it kind of dismantled that cohesiveness that we had. And then there was the violence that occurred within our own ranks with the infiltration. And it was just nasty and it was ugly. And it became scary, I think, for the first time. I really began to question, wow, well, what have I got myself into, and what do I do? Do I sit around? And because then I began to see that our ranks were falling apart. People were getting killed on a regular basis. And so in that turmoil, I actually ended up in California. My life just kind of started spinning. So I ended up in California. I got stranded out in California. So that's how I came back to Mississippi in 1971. And so I was out in California. And then I think because of my involvement and because people that I was associating with, the FBI was hot on my trail. And so I actually called my mom up and said, I want to come home. So she says, well, where are you? I said, I'm in California. It's just like, well, my God, what are you doing in California? How do you get to California? So anyway, I didn't have money. And so she actually paid from this end for me to fly back here to Mississippi. And my mom tried to get me settled into what she thought was a normal life. So she got me a job. No sooner than that, it was about a month or so after I was trying to live a normal life, and the FBI came looking for me, and they terrorized the community looking for me because they fabricated all these things about people that I was hanging out with, and it was kind of crazy. But I still was torn between whether I should stay here and try to build a normal life. I had two children at that time. So whether I should stay here and just try to live a quote-unquote normal life. But I always had that longing to be back and involved. And I did not seek out any SNCC people. I was still committed to the Panthers. So I ended back up in New York. About a year later, I went back to New York. And after I went back to New York, we were still trying to regroup as Panthers. We did our best to regroup, but it never quite came together. And then I think things escalated in terms of, you know, then there was the more militant arm of the Black Panther Party, the BLA, and all of that stuff. And so I stayed with a fragmented organizational wing until 1972 until about 74. And I decided that it was time that I kind of rethink my life and do more community organizing that was less threatening to myself and my children. And I went back to school eventually. I returned to college in 1977. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In my conversation with Leroy Johnson, I said, you have to write a book. And Frank, you have to write this book. I don't think people understand about the FBI. I don't think people understand what you just said it in a sense about infiltration. I don't think people realize that you'd have 15 people in a meeting. Three of them may be cops. They may be undercover cops, which split the Panthers apart. Do you think it's right that many of the most provocative things the Panthers did were very possibly encouraged by...
They were encouraged.
So what would you say, in a very short summary, drove you to seek the most militant, the most dangerous, the most effective, the most challenging forms of organization? Because between SNCC and the Black Panthers, you picked two amazing organizations. Mm-hmm. What inside of you do you think made you make that choice?
I know what inside me made me make that choice. I could never come to grips that being hit across my back haunted me. It still does. That face just stayed in my mind, the face of this redneck cracker hitting me across the back and feeling helpless that there was nothing I could do. And it made me question whether I truly was nonviolent. And I think, you know, the killing of Megan Everson and the killing of Martin Luther King. And what drove me to the Panthers is that the Panthers were at least saying, we will defend ourselves and we will use the Constitution to do that, that we will shoot back. We will defend ourselves.
Well, this is pretty moving. That was Frankie Adams Johnson, also known as Malika. A very fascinating story of a person truly dedicated to the movement. It's really been a pleasure to have you on Voices from the Frontline, KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. And please check out our website, www.voicesfromfrontlines.com. All power to the people.
All power to the people.